This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Okay, so I'm talking to Karen Masters, who is here on behalf of LOFAR. So tell us all about LOFAR.
LOFAR stands for the Low Frequency Array. It's a pan-European radio telescope. It's got stations, the bulk of it is in the Netherlands, and it's run out of the Netherlands. But there's also stations in Germany and Sweden, France and the UK. The UK station is in Hampshire, and it has almost 200 antennas, literally in a field, actually. Right over the fence, they grow the mushrooms that they sell at Waitrose. So it's a really nice rural location away from all sources of, or many sources of FM radio. LOFAR works at two frequency bands, just below and just above the FM radio bands. It has two types of antennas that do that. The low-band antennas, they look a little bit like tents, but without canvas. One of the fun things about LOFAR is that the station in the UK was actually built with the help of volunteer labour. The low-band antennas, the LBAs, were quite simple to put together, and so we didn't need any kind of massive technical expertise. So students and postdocs from universities in the southeast of the UK in the SETNET region, including lots of people from the University of Portsmouth, where I work, went to Gibraltar, and we spent a week commuting to Gibraltar and going and building these antennas. And we built 96 of the LBAs in a week. It's quite fun because all the bits are sent from the Netherlands. It's a little bit like a flat pack telescope. So these two lorries arrived with all the parts, and then we had to put it together. The high-band antenna is a little bit more complicated, and we're put together with the help of forklift trucks and professionals a little bit later in the summer. And the UK station was opened in September by Jocelyn Bell, and we had a nice opening ceremony. And we had the first light image, including the UK station, the French station, and one of the German stations, along with the Netherlands, several of the stations in the Netherlands. I think they have almost 30 now working in the Netherlands. That first light image was produced earlier this year, and showed the massive increase in resolution you get when you go from just the core in the Netherlands to including these outer international stations, or making the International LOFAR Telescope. It's a multi-acronym acronym, ILT.
So what kind of science is LOFAR intended to do?
LOFAR has several key science goals. One of the biggest is probably trying to detect the epoch of reionization. So this is the period in the universe when the first stars turned on. So if you go right back to the Big Bang, you have sort of the hot plasma at the Big Bang, and we know, people probably have heard of the CMB radiation. That's when the electrons first combined with protons, and the protons free-streamed across the universe. After that time, the universe was full of neutral hydrogen, just hydrogen atoms floating around, and very little structure. There were no stars, no galaxies, nothing like that. Very slowly, stuff collected under gravity, and eventually parts of the universe got dense enough for the first stars to turn on. When that happens, the first stars ionize all that neutral hydrogen, and that's what we call reionization. Now, neutral hydrogen emits a very characteristic radio line at 21 centimeters. Redshifted, you know, by these massive redshifts in the early universe, that's in the frequency range detectable by LOFAR, we hope. And we hope that we're going to detect this step when all of that neutral hydrogen suddenly gets ionized, and pin down the time at which the first stars were born in the universe.
Okay, so the hydrogen gets ionized and it stops emitting that 21 centimeter line.
That's exactly right, yeah. And so what you should see is this global step. You have lots of 21 centimeter radiation, and then suddenly you have very little, and think fairly quickly. Yeah. LOFAR can also do lots of other science. Like, for example, it's very, very, very good at detecting pulsars. Going back to the old way that we detected pulsars, you know, back in the 60s, sort of wires in a field. But now we've got 5,000 of them, all over Europe, making currently the largest radio telescope in the world, the most sensitive radio telescope in the world.
And presumably much, much more powerful computers than you had back in the 1960s.
Much, much, much more powerful computers. As I understand it, Jocelyn Bell detected pulsars by rolling strips of paper across the floor of her office. LOFAR is controlled by a supercomputer in the Netherlands and wouldn't be possible without the high-speed internet through fibre optics. Actually, if you consider the UK station, the parts, the components, the physical hardware is a negligible fraction of the cost. What we're spending all the money on is the high-speed internet connection to the Netherlands.
So how does LOFAR fit in with all the other telescopes that are currently being built around the world in the lead up to things like the Square Kilometre Array?
Well, LOFAR is really a pathfinder for the SKA. It's really the first of its kind of this new generation of radio telescopes, which have very simple components but are enabled by the massive increases in computing that we've had in the future. Europe is really leading the way in this field. In the US, they're building the long wavelength array, which is rather similar to LOFAR. It's going to be situated somewhere in the western US. And in Australia, they also have similar telescopes under construction.
Okay, so you're also involved with GalaxyZoo. Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing with that project.
Well, the most recent result we've had out from GalaxyZoo was the first result from the GalaxyZoo 2 classifications. So in Zoo 1, we just asked people to decide if the galaxy was spiral or elliptical. And in Zoo 2, we asked for a little bit more information. And one of the things that we asked about was whether or not the spiral galaxies or the disk galaxies had bars going across the centre. And this is just a linear structure that crosses the centre of, you know, between a third and two-thirds of spiral galaxies. So we actually took an early look at the results from that because we got so interested, because we saw one of my earlier results from GalaxyZoo was about red spirals. So most spiral galaxies are blue, and they're blue because the light that you see in them is dominated by young, hot blue stars that are very bright. Most ellipticals are red, and that's because they're not forming any stars anymore. And those young, hot, bright blue stars have all died off, leaving only the dim, red, less massive stars. And GalaxyZoo found this population of spirals that are as red as most ellipticals. And one of the things we noticed about them was that they seemed to have more bars than the normal blue spirals. So we took this early look at the bar classifications from Zoo 2, and we found that continued in the whole spiral population, that there's this strong correlation between colour and whether or not the galaxy has a bar. The red spirals are much more likely to have bars than bluer spirals. So that seems really intriguing, and you know, maybe suggests that bars, or sort of internal evolution from a bar, might be doing more to the spirals than we previously thought. What a bar does is, because it's not symmetric, it's not axially symmetric, it breaks the symmetry in the disk, and so it lets material move in and out along the bar, basically. So that's really curious. But I think actually my current theory is that the bars are more of a side effect. Once the spiral becomes red, you're much more likely to have a bar. And the reason is that it turns out bars form really, really quickly in any disk galaxy. So the big question really is why some don't have it. And actually, it turns out that's probably related to them killing themselves. Because they move material in and out along the bar, once they form, they basically self-destruct. It is one of the theories that's going around, you know, that people have done work on. But it seems that once you get rid of the gas in a galaxy, and the gas would be the fuel for star formation, so the red spirals, we think, don't have a lot of this gas because they're no longer forming stars. That's what's turned them red. So you got rid of the gas, and so once you build the bar, it sticks around for ages. I think that's probably what's going on, and what I've been working on lately is trying to look at whether or not spiral galaxies that have more gas in them, more fuel for star formation, are more likely to have bars or not.
Okay, cool. So yeah, you think about galaxies as having lots of gas in them, and that gas being used up in star formation, mm-hmm. but there's lots of other ways it can get dissipated as well, aren't there?
Well, that's right. Actually, one of the early puzzles about the Milky Way, actually, if you count the amount of gas there is in the disk of the Milky Way and you count the amount of stars that are forming, you quite quickly come to the realisation that you're going to use up all the gas really, really quickly. And so there was this model that came up that there must be gas raining onto the disk of the galaxy from a hot halo. So what we think is probably going on with the red spirals is that gas that's up in the halo, high off the disk and is very hot, has been stripped off. So there's no source of replenishment for the gas in the disk. And that's what's causing the spirals to become red and making them be more likely to have a bar.
And what gets rid of the gas in the halo?
It would be an interaction, probably, with another galaxy. It would be because the spiral is falling into a more massive halo, and then all light gas gets stripped off into the more massive halo, or maybe some sort of companion galaxy has come through and taken off all the gas.
So these red spirals, sort of, you see them more in galaxy groups and clusters and things?
Yeah, there's quite a clear correlation that they're more likely to be present in intermediate environments. We actually see them in all environments. Which tells you that it can't be a really strong environmental process. It can't be something like an interaction with a cluster, or it can't be something that requires a cluster that's turning them red. But this sort of gentle stripping off of gas in the halo can happen at quite low densities, can happen pretty much anywhere. But it is more likely to happen in intermediate environments, and so that's what makes you think that's a good candidate for the process.
So Galaxy Zoo is doing all these really cool things. What's sort of next? What's on the horizon for Galaxy Zoo as a project as a whole?
Well, what's running now at the Galaxy Zoo website, it's www.galaxyzoo.org, is Hubble Zoo. And this is, instead of Zoo 1 and Zoo 2 used images from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So there's a very local galaxies, effectively. Obviously, they're a long, long way away by human scales, but there's a galaxies, you know, really close by on galactic scales. In Hubble Zoo, we've moved to images from the Hubble Space Telescope, and these are now galaxies that are much, much further away, about half the age of the universe away. And so what we're hoping to do is be able to look at the evolution of morphology over the history of the universe. And so one thing in particular, we can look at how bars differed when the universe was half its current age and then they are now, and all sorts of other things as well.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. Look forward to hearing about it.
Thanks very much.